The title is America is Split. If everyone will stand for the scripture reading, it's found in Deuteronomy chapter 28, verses 30, 43 and 44. The stranger that is within thee shall get up above thee very high, and thou shalt come down very low. He shall lend to thee, and thou shalt not lend to him. He shall be the head, and thou shalt be the tail. You may be seated. Who shall be the head or the leader? Who shall be the tail or the follower? Deuteronomy chapter 28 tells us of what will happen if Israel fails to hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to keep his commandments and his statutes which he commanded thee. When Israel does this, they are going to be ruled by people who are not their own kind, that is, foreigners. They will be at the bottom of the rung. Now, is Israel keeping the law of God, or have they not been keeping his commandments and statutes? It is my opinion that Israel doesn't even know who they come from. They are ignorant that they are the descendants of Jacob and are the recipients of the Abrahamic covenant. Look at what Stu Peter said on one of his internet host programs. Quote, I don't know what else has to happen to show the world, or just show the people of this country, for that matter, that the United States government is in no way at the service of the United States. It is in no way under the control of the American people. It's an organ of Israeli, which means Jewish, war machine, and soon that'll be officially be linked, inked into the signed and passed legislation. For now, it is just a simple reality that we all face. The United States military is under the command of Benjamin Netanyahu, and the criminals he surrounds himself with, and American troops are living under their jurisdiction. Whatever is happening, it doesn't serve America. It doesn't serve the American people. It only serves Israel, which he means the Jews. A provision in a bill before the United States Congress could tie the U.S. and Israeli militaries far more closely together, deepening their cooperation on weapons, research, production, and technology. And there's a picture of Benjamin Netanyahu. The proposal, titled United States-Israel Defense Technology Corporation Initiative, appears in Section 224 of the House Armed Services Committee version of the Fiscal Year 2027 National Defense Authorization Act, the annual U.S. defense policy bill. The measure is still at an early stage. The NDAA is passed by Congress each year to set U.S. military policy and authorize defense programs and spending levels. If enacted, the provision could mark a significant change in one of the world's closely military relationships, shifting the two countries, the descendants of Esau and the descendants of Jacob, from a partnership centered largely on U.S. military aid towards one in which their defense entities are more deeply intertwined. Which side do you agree with? Is the U.S. military being put under control or being greatly influenced by the power of a stranger? No politician on the side of the Zionists has been convicted of treason. Revelation 12:9, and the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. In my last sermon, I pointed out the email on May 8, 2026, that Christians United for Israel sent out. It was called Rise Above the Lies. It had a picture, I think you remember, of Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens on the outside with Ben Shapiro on the inside. It called Tucker and Candace demonic for what they said about Israelite and Ben the teller of truth. And I've got the picture once again. They then gave 10 lies that they said was promoted on the internet, and they gave what they considered the truth. I want to point out lie number 2 that they gave and say some more about it. And lie number 2, CUFI said the following. Lie number 2, Jews are the oppressors. CUFI truth, Jewish history is defined not by domination, but by persecution, survival, and resilience. To test that history into a narrative of oppression is morally bankrupt. Well, the answer that I gave was the Jews were the aggressors in many battles that they have had in the past. For example, I named the Romans, the Russians, and some of the recent wars that their bankers participated in. I mentioned, lastly, the Jewish Mafia. I did not have the time to expand this topic in that sermon, but I will do so in this sermon. Again, in my last sermon, I told the congregants what happened in 1865, the year the war between the states ended. It was the worst war America has ever participated in. War soldiers, almost 750,000, 750,000 died, counting both sides, and the Union Army destroyed the South's previous way of living. Many of the churches in the South were annihilated, both literally and figuratively. Many of the men were killed in battle, and their farms, including their animals, were destroyed. After the war between the Union and the Confederates, the American Jewish population was relatively small, estimated at around 200,000 to 250,000 people. But between 1880 to 1924, the total number of Jewish immigrants was over 3 million, many of them refugees. This made the United States the world's largest Jewish community. There were over 4 million Jewish people in the United States in the 1920s. During this time, something happened which changed the course of history. Prohibition, at least in the United States. It lasted for 13 years, from January 17, 2020, till December 5, 1933. The 18th Amendment to the Constitution banned the production, transportation, and sale of alcoholic beverages, not their consumption. The street gangs, which were small and didn't have much wealth, gained prosperity during this time of legal absence of alcohol production. Jewish gangs eagerly seized prohibition, thank you, as a massive economic opportunity, transforming loose street crews into a sophisticated corporate underworld. Arnold Rothstein, who happens to be in Erica Kirk's family tree, dominated bootlegging, extortion, rum running, and smuggling operations, forging powerful alliances, and laid the groundwork for modern organized crime. They also established speakeasies in back rooms and paid off the police to protect their now illegal alcohol drinking establishments. Arnold Rothstein modernized the mob, running illegal operations with the efficiency of a major business. Jewish gangs built complex distribution systems such as the Little Jewish Navy in Cleveland. Jewish mobsters partnered seamlessly with Italian-American counterparts like Lucky Luciano, forming the National Crime Syndicate, and enforcement groups like Murder Incorporated, which committed over 400 contact murders, many of disobedient mafia members. When Prohibition took effect, many thousands of formerly legal saloons across the country catering only to men closed. People wanting to drink alcohol had to buy liquor from licensed druggists for medicinal purposes, clergymen for religious reasons, or illegal sellers known as bootleggers. As bootlegging enriched criminals throughout America, New York became America's center for organized crime. At the height of Prohibition, the late 20s, there were 32,000 speakeasies in New York alone. Speakeasies got their name by the fact to enter the establishment, you had to speak easy so not to be overheard by law enforcement. The competition for patrons and speakeasies created demand for live entertainment. The already popular jazz music and the dances inspired in speakeasies and clubs fit into the era's raucous party mood, with the thousands of underground clubs and the prevalence of jazz bands, liquor-infused partying grew during the roaring 20s, when the term dating, young singles meeting without parental supervision, was first introduced into society. Ah, when did dating start in America? Let's just stop right here. You mean there was no dating until the 1920s in America? Then how did your grandparents and great-grandparents get together and marry? They courted. The first and probably most important change America's found in courtship practices in the West occurred in the early 20th century, when courtship moved from public acts conducted in private spaces, for instance, the family porch or the parlor, to private or individual acts conducted in public places located primarily in the entertainment world, which was also controlled by the Jews. Dating took place in movie theaters and dance halls, removed by distance and anonymity from the sheltering and controlling context of the home and the local community. Keeping company in the family home gave way to dating that took place in dining locations, dance halls, movie theaters, and in many cases, parking in quiet places. A second cultural force that influenced the older courtship system was the rise of public advice literature, as well as the rise of an expert class of advisors. That would be psychologists, sociologists, statisticians, most of whom were Jews, etc. At the same time that the public entertainment culture was on the rise in the early 20th century, a rapid increase in the number of magazine articles and books began offering advice about courtship, marriage, and the new dating situation. Thirdly, Americans saw a change in sexual norms in the West culture. With the onset of the sexual revolution, the question arose, why would a man court and woo a woman when he could gain a chief benefit of marriage, namely sexual gratification for free with no commitment? Closely related to this is the invention of birth control. Simply put, with the onset of the widespread use of chemical or other means of birth control, the idea of the purpose of marriage being the rearing of children was forgotten. Under the old system of courtship, marriage and bringing a child into the world were indistinguishably linked, but no longer. With the ever-decreasing risk of pregnancy, having sex and being married was no longer tied together. But if a woman did experience an unwanted pregnancy, she could abort or murder her own flesh and blood. There have been close to 70 million abortions since the Supreme Court made their ruling in 1973 in the United States. United States, in its 250-year history, has lost only a little more than 1 million servicemen in the armed forces. 70 times more abortions than we lost in the armed forces. Think God's angry? Fourthly, Americans found a change in models and metaphors used to describe the home and family. Prior to the 20th century, when Americans talked about courtship, they used language and metaphors of home and family. He'd be a good father. They could have such a happy home together, etc. And fifthly, Americans experienced life-changing technology that drastically altered the way Americans began to meet each other sexually. The horse and buggy gave way to the automobile. The knock on the door gave way to the telephone. The staying with the girl in the parlor of their home gave way of going to movies or dance halls. Eating a dinner at the girl's house with her family gave way to a guy buying the girl a meal at a restaurant. All this made courtship out of date for most of the young people. And now it is even more advanced, as technology now dictates through social media a way of dating that the parents could have no impact on the child in the dating process. Before they even met in the old days of courtship, the boy had to ask the girl's father if he could have a meeting with his daughter. If he said no, the daughter never knew if he had asked him unless she was informed by her father. Parents used to know who their children were going out with and what was the purpose of their meeting. Two questions many parents would ask the male suitor was, can you support our daughter? And two, what are your intentions? If the father agreed, the two were chaperoned by family member or members, and the event usually lasted about a half hour to an hour in the parlor or porch. Nowadays, many parents are unaware of who their daughter or son are even dating, especially now with mobile phones and internet dating services, and with many females living on their own. When the boy was courting and he desired to marry her, he would first go to her father and request his permission to marry her. If her father said no, there was no marriage. The girl did not even have a decision to make. But if the father said yes, then the girl had to make her mind if she wanted to marry him. It was her, him, and both sets of parents that had to agree on the marriage. There are many cases today where parents learn of who their child has been dating when they become engaged. Out of necessity, this culture confusion has forced Christians to reevaluate from where we are taking our cues, from the secular culture at large, or from a wise contemporary application of what is in Scripture. In many Christian communities, there seems to be a movement towards rediscovering or creating anew some sort of script that conforms itself to the way God created man and women to relate to each other. New types of courtship where family, friends, and church communities are involved in the relationship provide support and godly counsel to individuals in a relationship. Realizing how spiritually, psychologically, and physically destructive sexual relations are outside of the bond and vow of marriage, many teens and young adults, both men and women, are committing or recommitting themselves to chastity. All these are encouraging signs. Probably the only people I know that still do courtship is the Amish. They have no phones. They have horse and buggy, no cars. I think they are the only ones. Anyway, my mother would talk of what she and her sisters and two brothers would do when one of them went on a special outing with a person who was of the opposite sex. There was always several brothers and sisters that would go with them on their time together. My brother and sister and I would laugh when my mother told us this. We thought it was very funny. But now I see that it was a transition from courtship to dating. In addition, the sisters and my mother's family were not allowed to live on their own until they got married. My grandfather made them turn down a singing contract if they moved to California because they were not allowed to leave home. When my siblings and I went on dates, there was no other family members, including our parents, who were with us. We went to different events, dances, ball games, movies, etc. Time had changed, and most of it never knew it. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll were ready to spring forth and lead America into a multitude of sins. Now we go back to the 20s. Speakeasies were ill-kept secrets, and owners exploited low-paid police officers with payoffs to look the other way, enjoy a regular drink, or tip them off about planned raids by federal prohibition agents. Bootleggers who supplied the private bars would add water to good whiskey, gin, and other liquors to sell larger quantities. Others resorted to selling still-processed moonshine and industrial alcohol, wood or grain alcohol, even poisonous chemicals such as carbolic acid. The harmful stuff, such as smoke made of pure wood alcohol, killed or maimed thousands of drinkers. To hide the taste of poorly distilled whiskey and bathtub gin, speakeasies also combine alcohol with ginger ale, Coca-Cola, sugar, mint, lemon, fruit drinks, and other flavors, promoting the enduring mixed drink or cocktail in the process. Once Prohibition was over, the newly found wealth supported the gambling organizations, prostitution, pornography, drug operations, extortion, and political control by bribery. Arnold Rothstein changed the Jewish gangs into an organized corporation, and he controlled the operations in New York City as an influencer, financier, gambler, and fixer. Rather than ruling a city through brute force, he wielded national influence by funding bootlegging, fixing major sports events, and organizing minor modern crime syndicates across the East Coast. Arthur Rothstein, Erica Kirk's cousin's grandfather, was shot and killed over a card game debt that totaled $320,000 over 3 days. He refused to pay it because he didn't think the game was conducted in a fair way. After he was shot on the staircase, he fell near the door. When the police arrived, they asked him the question, "Who shot you, Mr. Rothstein?" He answered through his pain, "You stick to your trade, and I will stick with mine." He died 2 days later. He never named the shooter. This was not just another gangster going down. This was the man who organized modern organized crime in America. Arnold Rothstein didn't carry a gun. He didn't run with street thugs. He wore custom Brooks Brothers suits, kept his fingernails manicured, and operated out of Lindsay's Delicatessen on Broadway like a Fortune 500 CEO. He bankrolled bootleggers. He fixed the 1919 World Series. Thank you for letting Cincinnati win a World Series. Ran the biggest gambling empire in the nation. Set up the first heroin and morphine drug operation in the United States, 1926. And financed the careers of many mobsters. His top proteges, including Lucky Luciano, you might have heard of some of these gangsters, Meyer Lansky, His real name is Meyer, and look at that name, it's from Russian. The last part of his name is where he got Lansky from. Bugsy Siegel, Frank Costello, Dutch Schultz, Jack Diamond, and every major mobster you ever heard of. Without Arthur Rothstein, there is no Kosher Nostra, the Jewish mafia, as we know it. The Jewish gang spread to Detroit, Chicago, Newark, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, Miami, Cuba, Ohio, and Northern Kentucky? Yes. It happened in our own backyard. When I lived in Roselawn, we know about Newport. It was called the Sin City. Anyway, the Jewish Mafia, I didn't know it was the Jewish Mafia, often operated as part of the broader Cleveland Syndicate and National Jewish American Racketeering Networks, centered its Northern Kentucky operation primarily in Newport and Covington, right across the river from Cincinnati. Home to upscale illegal casinos like the Yorkshire Club at 518 York Street and the Flamingo Club, 633 York Street, which were managed or financed by out-of-town Jewish mob figures and associates working alongside the Cleveland Syndicate. Controlled for decades by the Cleveland Syndicate, this prominent location housed a highly profitable underground casino in the back rooms before later transitioning into Beverly Hills Supper Club. I will quote two paragraphs from the Northern Kentucky Tribune. Here's the two paragraphs. Known as Little Mexico and later the Sin City of the South, Newport, Kentucky has had many sayings that describe its widespread criminal activity. Concerned reformers tried to rid Newport of its open vice image. There had been reform movements in Newport and Campbell County dating back to the early 1900s, but all had failed. This was mainly caused by the years of distrust and animosity between the Protestant and Catholic communities, which prohibited the cohesion needed to reform the prevailing vices successfully. For three decades, that's 30 years before 1961, so from the 1930s to 61, no Campbell County jury convicted a gambling establishment except when the Jewish syndicate needed to acquire more casinos from rival competitors. The Jewish Cleveland Syndicate and the Mayfield Road Mob are the accepted destination used by scholars to refer to two separate organized crime organizations that were based in Cleveland, Ohio, and operated enterprises in Newport, Kentucky, when I was alive and in high school. And what is the Beverly Hills Supper Club famous for today? The venue drew acts like Frankie Valli, Phyllis Diller, Red Fox, John Davidson, James Brown, the Righteous Brothers, and Rich Little, to name a few. The setting was aggressively luxurious. Brocaded gold walls stood out royally against striking maroon partitions. The chandeliers were fabulous, always gleaming without a speck of dust. A grand spiral staircase imposed. An indoor waterfall amazed. A lushy manicured backyard beckoned. The food was widely acclaimed as superb. The flagship entree was a massive prime rib. But on the night of May 28th, 1977, with John Davidson scheduled to perform before a beyond sellout house, the Beverly Hills burned to the ground. 165 people died. Davidson was among an estimated 2,600 who escaped, but the death toll was the highest of any disaster in greater Cincinnati history, man-made or natural. There are theories about arson by mafia types who have been rebuffed in bids to gain control when they refuse the sale of the restaurant entertainment complex. What else did the Jewish mafia do that affected world history? And I never knew this part. Maybe you did, but I never knew this part. When Prohibition was almost ready to be repealed, it was repealed December 5th, 1933, what was going on in the United States? America was in the Great Depression. Following the stock market crash, October 1929, and it lasted a year before I was born, 1941. I was born in 1942. In August 1933, the year following the death of President Hindenburg in Germany, Hitler combined the offices of Chancellor and President, declaring himself Führer, an absolute dictator. The Jews quickly held rallies and meetings to boycott German goods because the Germans had told the Jewish Rothschild Bank to leave the country. Germany went from poverty to prosperity very quickly. It only took 4 years. World War I ended in the Jewish favor. Germany was taken over by the Jewish element in their country. And after they had been betrayed by this religious element, the Germans were put in a disastrous position. It was called the Weimar Republic. There were high unemployment, close to 40%, and a high inflation rate. You had to take a wheelbarrow of cash to buy a loaf of bread. It was known as Sodom and Gomorrah of Europe. It had pornography, transgenderism, homosexuality, usury, Freemasonry, Jehovah's Witness, who say that Jesus was not the Son of God, but the created Archangel Michael, prostitution, gambling, drunkenness, oh, much like the United States is now. We have all that. But Germany got wise. They voted in Adolf Hitler, began to make the necessary changes. They got rid of the Jewish National Rothschild Bank, which charged usury in Germany, for starters. They put everyone to work. I should say they put all the men to work. And Germany very quickly became the most prosperous nation in the world. Then they started to get rid of the pornography, transgenderism, inflation, homosexuality, usury, Freemasonry, Jehovah's Witnesses, prostitution, gambling, communists, the best they could. It was no longer known as Sodom and Gomorrah of Europe. What? Germany was prospering with its scientists inventing things that were years ahead of most of the other nations. If you remember what Harold talked about, you know what they did. It held the Olympics in 1936 in Germany. Employers were discouraged from taking on women. Women were encouraged to stay home and be good wives and mothers, alongside with giving increased family benefits for doing so. They took women off the unemployment list and paid them to breed more children. In 1937, a new sponsored car manufacturer was commissioned by Hitler to provide cheap cars for families. It was called Volkswagen. Volks means the people, wagon means car. And families were encouraged to buy one by making monthly payments. That's how the Volkswagen came into being. Unemployment was banned by the Nazi Party and went from 5 million to zero in a space of a few years. Every unemployed man had to start an available job or risk being sent to prison. Non-Germans had their citizenship removed and thus were not eligible for employment. Work teams were created from unemployed Germans, and companies were given money if they employed more workers. Massive infrastructure building projects were established. In the space of 4 years, Nazi Germany changed from being a defeated nation, a bankrupt economy, strangled by war debt, inflation, and lack of foreign capital, into full employment with the strongest economy and the biggest military power in Europe. That's pretty good. We're depressed. They're prospering. What did the Jews do next? Germany had gone in 4 years from bankruptcy to prosperity. America and most of the rest of the world is in a deep depression. The Jews rallied and had meetings that tried to boycott all German goods. It worked a little bit, was not stopping the German prosperity. Germany was no longer the cesspool of depravity. But America was getting farther away from their Lord and Savior. What happened? I wasn't born, so I didn't. I did not learn about this in my classes in high school or the university. I discovered it when I was 83 years old, just a couple months ago. Let's take a quick review of history. United States had the apotheosis of Washington painted underneath the dome of the Capitol building with close to a dozen Roman gods and goddesses. Soon after, many Jews emigrated from Russia, Germany, Poland, Ukraine, etc., into the United States. Many of them went to New York, Baltimore, Boston, Chicago, and other of the large cities. In the early 1900s, many of them lived in poverty and in ghettos. Young men formed gangs to help them provide the substance for their families. Then Prohibition happened. Rothstein ran casinos, crap games, and financial networks connecting corrupt politicians, police officers, and emerging gangsters. He invested heavily in horse racing track in this area, where he was known to manipulate race outcomes. Rothstein acted as a major wholesaler of illicit liquor, and a central banker for criminal enterprises stretching from New York through major Atlantic corridors. In 1913, Jewish bankers pushed through the Federal Reserve System, inserted the income, which is really a wage tax, started the Anti-Defamation League, the Internal Revenue Service, and in general took over control of the nation. Samuel Untermeyer, a Jew, blackmailed President Wilson into appointing an Antichrist Jew to the Supreme Court. His name was Brandeis. And getting into World War I by paying his mistress the fee that she wanted and saving him from being dismissed from the presidency. As soon as Hitler was elected, the Jewish hierarchy in America became alarmed. They immediately started their economic war with Germany, which was 1933. They held massive rallies in Madison Square Garden and advocated that the nations shouldn't buy any goods from Germany. But the Jews had another problem. There were a lot of German immigrants in the United States. For instance, Germans settled Cincinnati. Today, over 40 million Americans report Germany as their primary ancestry, making it the largest self-reported ancestral group in the United States. So where was the support for Nazism in the United States in the 30s? I don't know. I wasn't alive. What happened in the 1930s in America? To my surprise, there was. One group, which I never heard of, the German America Bund, was the largest and was operating with public rallies, marches, and even operated indoctrination camps. Mainstream Jewish organizations feared that counting these events publicly could incite even more anti-Jewishism and hurt their economic war. How could the Jews stop these rallies which supported Hitler and Germany? The 1930s in America was a period of rampant anti-Jewishness, particularly in the Midwest. Have you heard of Father Charles Coughlin? Detroit's radio priest, and William Pelley of Minneapolis, they both openly called for Jews to be driven from positions of responsibility, if not from the country itself. A decade before I was born, I was flabbergasted to learn that there were calls from high-up leaders in America to have the Jews removed from our country like they removed back in the Middle Ages. Removed from the United States of America. Organized brown shirts in New York and silver shirts in Minneapolis both outraged and terrorized American Jewry. While the older and more respectable Jewish organizations pondered a response that would not alienate non-Jewish supporters, others, including rabbis, asked for help in breaking up American Nazi rallies. What happened? Do you know what happened? Have you ever thought about the question? If you were alive during this time, would you have been in support of the German Nazis? Or the people who Jesus said were the offspring of the devil, the American Jews? Would you have been on the sidelines? My parents never said one word about this time to us. Frustrated by the lack of action on the part of the Jewish people, former congressman and judge Nathan D. Perlman, who of course was a Jew, approached notorious Jewish mobster Meyer Lansky. Remember, Meyer Lansky was financed and taught the mafia way by Arnold Rothstein, who was a Jew. Meyer Lansky, along with a few other Jewish mobsters, Bugsy Siegel, who started Las Vegas, Lonzi Zwillman, and Moer Dates, was recruited by the New York judge Nathan D. Perlman to violently disrupt the Buns meeting and beat up the fascists, but they were not to kill any of the pro-German Americans. Enthusiastic for the assignment, if disappointed by the restraints, Lansky accepted all of Perlman's term except for one. He would not take no money for the work. Lansky later observed, quote, "I was a Jew and felt for those Jews in Europe who were suffering. They were my brothers." Of course, Lansky had over $300 million, which would be $2 billion today. He was very wealthy. For months, Lansky's workmen effectively broke up one Nazi rally after another. Nazi arms, legs, and ribs were broken, and skulls were cracked, but no one died. But many were severely wounded and wound up in the hospital. Lansky and his associates, along with other underworld figures, regularly raided Nazi gatherings, armed with lead pipes, baseball bats, brass knuckles, and their fists. They stormed venues such as the Yorkville Casino in Manhattan, beat the bond members, smashed their equipment, and forced them to flee. None of them ever went to prison for what they did. They paid the police off too. Look at how one of the gangsters describes the event. Quote, "The stage was decorated with a swastika and a picture of Hitler. speaker started ranting. There was only 15 of us, but we went into action. We threw some of them out of the windows. Most of the Nazis panicked and ran out. We chased them and beat them up. We wanted to show them that Jews would not always sit back and accept insults. In Minneapolis, William Dudley Pelley organized a Silver Shirt Legion to rescue America from a quote-unquote imaginary Jewish communist conspiracy. It was not imaginary. In Pelley's own words, just as, quote, Mussolini and his black shirts saved Italy, and as Hitler and his brown shirts saved Germany, he would save America from Jewish communists. He said that? Question. Did Pelley save America from Jewish communists, or did the communists win? Minneapolis gambling czar David Berman, who was a Jew, confronted Pelley's silver shirts on behalf of the Minneapolis Jewish community. Berman learned that silver shirts were manning a rally at a nearby Elks Lodge. When the Nazi leader called for all the Jew bastards, that's a quote, in the city to be expelled or worse, Berman and his associates burst into the room and started cracking heads. After 10 minutes, they had emptied the hall. His suit covered in blood, Berman took the microphone and announced, quote, this is a warning. Anybody who says anything against Jews gets the same treatment. Only next time, it will be worse, unquote. That is Jewish free speech. After Berman broke up two more rallies, there were no more public silver shirt meetings in Minneapolis. It was then expanded to Chicago. Perlman contacted Jewish gangster Jake Juzik, who was a close friend to Al Capone. Everybody knows Al Capone, a Jewish gangster. Guzik asked some Jewish boxers, tough guys from Chicago's West Side, men who fight in illegal rings and who collect debts for the mafia. One of these boxers was Jacob Rubenstein. After dropping out of high school, he worked at various jobs, one in which he received $1 for delivering sealed envelopes for Al Capone. He answered the call from Guzik to help in the Jewish fight against the pro-German Nazi rallies in Chicago. Jack was born to two Polish Jewish parents, one a drunk father and the other suffered mental illness as mother. He and his seven brothers and sisters were placed in foster homes for a period in the 20s. In his mid-20s, he was part of a Jewish pool hall crowd that attacked the pro-Hitler German-American Buddhist rally meetings. One of his acquaintances reported that Ruby was responsible for cracking a few heads of Boone members. Apparently, he joined in this activity for ethnic rather than political reasons. The young men in the group are not organized adherents of any political creed, but were pool hall and tavern companions from Ruby's Jewish neighborhood who gathered on the spur of the moment to present opposition when they learned that the pro-Nazi and anti-Semitic Boone movement was planning a meeting. He much later went to live in Dallas, Texas, where he became very wealthy, operating several nightclubs, dance hall, and strip joints. It was there he became famous for murdering the alleged shooter of President JFK, Lee Harvey Oswald. Millions witnessed the shooting live on television. He was tried and convicted of murder and sentenced to death. But eventually the death sentence was removed, and he died in prison of pneumonia awaiting a new trial. Why did he kill the alleged shooter of the president, who denied he killed Kennedy? Many said that Rubenstein didn't want Oswald to testify or the truth would come out. Perlman's strategy of hurt but do not kill continued in the large cities across America. Los Angeles, Cleveland, Newark, and Detroit were handled in the same way. The meetings were made fearful by baseball bats, lead pipes, brass knuckles, fists that the gangsters smuggled into the meetings and used against the American Nazis. Though nearly forgotten today, how come I didn't know about that in American history? The Bund once boasted a nationwide membership in the tens of thousands and had chapters in nearly every major American city. Millions more saw newsreel footage of goose-stepping Bund members mimicking Hitler's stormtroopers, or read newspaper exposés about Bund's secret training camps for children and adults alike. In Washington, politicians and law enforcement officers wondered what the Bund's leaders might be plotting. The German-American Bund was founded in 1936, and led by a German immigrant and nationalized American citizen named Fritz Kuhn. Did you ever hear of Fritz Kuhn? I did. In theory, the Bund was merely an organization of German Americans who wanted to stay in touch with their former homeland. The Bund had been created from the remains of an organization called Friends of the New Germany that had openly supported Adolf Hitler and his plans for the Third Reich. That organization was shut down when the German government decided it was too disreputable and might endanger Germany's relationships with the U.S. The Bund then was supposedly to be a more respectable way for German Americans to stay in touch with their former country, but also show support for its new leader, Hitler. Bund's ideology was more closely aligned with the Reich than its leaders wanted to admit. Fritz Kuhn himself was a World War I veteran who had won the Iron Cross. After the war, he joined the Nazi Party and brawled with communists on the streets of Munich. He later claimed to have been present for the failed Bier Herr Putsch that landed Hitler in prison. In 1923, he moved to Mexico and later settled in Detroit, where he worked for the Ford Motor Company. Henry Ford was anti-Jewish. There was one last rally planned by the German Bund on September 20th, 1939. The Bund held a massive 20,000 people were packed into the famous arena at Madison Square Garden to show the world that Germans in America were proud of the work that Hitler and the Nazis were doing in Germany. A few of the statements the Kuhn said were, quote, "The Bund is fighting shoulder to shoulder with patriot Americans to protect America from a race that is not the American race. There's not even a white race. The Jews are controlling everything. The Jews are enemies of the United States. All Jews are communists. Jesus Christ was not a Jew." Would we have supported what Kuhn said? Do we believe that America needs protection from a group of immigrants that are descendants of the people that murdered our Savior? Do we believe the Jews control everything? Do we believe the Jews are the enemies of the United States and of the church that Jesus started? Do we believe that Christ was not a Jew? Inside this Madison Square Garden meeting, a Jewish plumber named Inador Greenbaum notably rushed the stage and attempted to pull the plug on the microphone before being arrested. Kuhn had said that he was against, quote, "Jewish domination," and called for a socially just, white, Gentile rule United States, unquote. Isidore said in court the reason why he had done it. Greenbaum explained, quote, "I went down to the garden without any intention of interrupting, but being that they talked so much against my religion, which is an anti-Jesus Christ religion, and there was so much persecution, I lost my head and felt it was my duty to talk. Greenbaum was a victim and a hero to a lot of people. It was a turning point in America's struggle in the battle of Jew versus Germany. According to historian Michael Benson, author of Gangsters versus Nazis, these violent and intimidating tactics successfully shamed and intimidated the Bund members, ultimately causing many of the fascists to stay away from public rallies out of fear of retribution. I take you to John 7:13. Howbeit no man spake openly of him, referring to Jesus Christ, for fear of the Jews, which is the Edomite Jews. I didn't know there was such a struggle in America less than a decade before I was born. I wondered why America had no protest, since many of its American citizens had come from Germany over the years. Now I know what happened. My conclusion. The best known Jewish gangsters participated in the numbers rackets, illegal drug dealing, prostitution, gambling, and loan sharking. Very good organizations to be a member of. They were not nice men. During the rise of American Nazism in the 30s and when Israel was being founded between 1948 and 1978, however, they proved staunch defenders of their people, the Jews. They helped supply their people, who had just been given part of Palestine, guns and ammunition from Panama because it was legal for the United States to do so. The Jewish gangsters helped fund Israel. That's a whole nother sermon. The roots of Jewish gangsters lay in the economic, ethnic neighborhoods of Lower East Side, Brownsville, Brooklyn, Maxwell Street in Chicago, and the Boyle Heights in Los Angeles. Like other newly arrived groups in American history who were blocked from access to respectable professions, a few Jews used crimes as a means to make good economically. The market for vice flourished during Prohibition, and Jews exploited the illegal market created by the bans on alcohol, gambling, paid sex, and narcotics. Few of these men were religiously observant. They rarely attended services, although they did support congregations financially. They did not keep kosher or send their children to day schools. However, at crucial moments, they protected other Jews in America and around the world. My question, why was it that big-time gangsters, mafia Jews, were fighting the Nazis in America? They used Jewish mafia gangsters to do their fighting. No gangster was ever convicted in court. If you were alive during the time, which side would you have been on? The gangster Jewish mafia, the Americans in defense of the Nazis, or no one? No Negroes, no Asians, no Caucasians, no Pacific Islanders, no Indians, just Jewish mafia gangsters fought against the Nazis in America. What did the Nazis believe that was so abhorrent to the Americans? They fought against and made laws against communism, known as Marxism, Freemasonry, transgenderism, homosexuality, pornography, usury, extortion, Jehovah's Witnesses, prostitution, gambling, unemployment, etc. But where'd somebody do that in America? Are you against all these things that Germany did and was successful against? They were also against the Jews, had promoted all the above. Now America has the Frankfurt School that has moved from Germany to be in the United States, with many of the Jews still controlling us by promoting homosexuality, Marxism, same-sex marriages, transgenderism, Freemasonry, usury, Jehovah's Witnesses, prostitution, gambling, practically on everything, lotteries, women in the workplace and military, and with church attendance and beliefs being challenged and making salvation available to everyone. Do you believe what the Jewish, what the Christian United for Israel say at the Jewish Cornerstone Church in San Antonio, led by Pastor John Hange? He sent me this email just a week or so ago. Dayton, Ohio. Learn why you should stay with Israel and what you can do to defend Israel. As the largest pro-Israel organization in the United States, with over 10 million members, Christians United for Israel is the foremost Christian organization, educating and empowering millions of Americans to speak and act with one voice in defense of Israel and the Jewish people. I learned a long time ago that it wasn't through sports that one would be able to succeed against the evilness of this world. It wouldn't be through the education world, or the cooking world, or the gardening world, or the health world. It'd be through the teaching our people who our enemy is, and that the only hope on our side is that we have our Savior. He is not in hell, as the sons of Esau say. He is in heaven, seated on the right hand of God the Father, who will soon return and save us from forsaking him once again. Blessed be the Lord God of Israel.